The fates that ordained the solar system drew a line in the sand and issued a direct challenge with Titan. They tossed us a few easy but tantalizing clues. We curious humans can't resist when we're teased like that. But the surface was hidden from the Voyagers. Come back in 15 years when you've learned to see in the infrared, chuckled the fates. You are listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, the home of WEAG favorite John Labatt in London, Ontario, Canada. Now, ever since Gerard Kuiper's observations in the 1940s, we knew that Titan was a special place. The only moon in the solar system with a substantial atmosphere, we didn't really get a close-up look at the place until the late 1970s with the Pioneer 11 spacecraft. And when we did see it, what we saw perplexed us. The surface of the planet was entirely hidden beneath a photochemical smog, giving the moon the appearance of an orange. We tried again in the early 80s with the Voyager spacecraft, and as you will hear, we sacrificed Voyager 1 to get a closer peek. In retrospect, Voyager 1 did get a faint hint of the surface that lay below, but we needed the clear images that would be made in the infrared by the Hubble Space Telescope and later by Cassini to really understand that those faint ghosts were real. However, there is one technology that has no issue whatsoever with Titan's veil. Synthetic aperture radar, or SAR, previously used by Magellan to map the surface of Venus, has really allowed us to see the character of Titan clearly. From dunes to lakes, it is a varied landscape, and one that tonight's guest, Dr. Catherine Niche, has been exploring since the start of her graduate career. Dr. Niche has worked extensively with Cassini radar data along with the originator of tonight's quote, Ralph Lorenz. Both are also hoping to work together to further our exploration of this enigmatic world. You'll hear all about that and more in the interview to follow from our newest co-host, CPSX doctoral candidate, Marianne Mader. Appropriately for such an exotic landscape, Vangelis Light and Shadow is our music tonight.
We're joined here today with Catherine Niche. We're going to be talking about her research today, which is pretty exciting. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So let's just get started. If you could just give us a little bit of background about the type of research that you do.
One of my primary focuses is using radar wavelengths to study the objects in our solar system. While we normally see things with our eyes at very short wavelengths, optical wavelengths, you can actually look at things at a wide variety of wavelengths, from the very small to the very large. And so you can look at objects at scales that are similar to human beings or buildings, centimeters or meters large. And this is great for learning new things about planetary bodies. In particular, you can look through atmospheres with radar wavelengths. They're transparent, and so you can see the surfaces of planets that you might not have been able to see with your eyes.
That's great. So what planetary bodies have you looked at using this technique?
Pretty much any planet I can get my hands on data. I'm really excited to look at it. But the one that is perhaps closest to my heart is not a planet at all. It's a moon. It's the largest moon of Saturn. It's called Titan. And Titan has a very thick, opaque atmosphere. It's basically a big orange blob in space, and if I were orbiting there as an astronaut, that's all I'd see was a big orange blob. But if you take a big radar flashlight and you point it at Titan, you can see below all the haze and muck in its atmosphere to the wonderful surface that's below.
Oh, that's fascinating. So you're hunting, you're searching on Titan, but what are you looking for when you're looking through this thick atmosphere?
Right. Well, I mean, it's a bit like being an explorer. You're not really sure what you're going to find, and that's what I think appeals to me so much about planetary science. And so for many years, we had some ideas about what the surface of Titan might look like, but it wasn't until 2004, when the Cassini spacecraft arrived in orbit around Saturn, that we got a glimpse of its surface for the first time. Prior to this time, people had speculated that Titan might have a global ocean of liquid ethane. So the gas that you put in your car, there'd be a planet covered with hundreds of meters of ethane and methane on its surface. But when we got there, of course, all of our ideas were thrown out the window. There was no global ocean of ethane. But instead, we found something perhaps more intriguing, and that's a world that looks surprisingly like our own.
Oh, so in what way is it similar to Earth? Is there even potential for life?
Well, so some people think so. I think I'm on the side that thinks it would be difficult to have life on Titan because, unlike the Earth, it is very, very cold. It's about 200 degrees below the freezing point of water, so the surface is actually made out of water ice. It's just very cold, and like I said, you have these liquid hydrocarbons flowing across the surface. So in some ways it's very alien from Earth, but in the process of these liquid hydrocarbons flowing across the surface of Titan, it has turned it into a very Earth-like planet. You see you see seas and lakes and streams. In addition, you see sand dunes, but they're not the sand dunes you might have seen on Earth. They're probably made out of organic gunk that's fallen out of the atmosphere. So there's lots of really interesting features on its surface that gives it a very Earth-like appearance.
Oh, that's really fascinating. And the features that you're describing that you can see on the surface, what scale of feature can you see?
Part of the problem with exploring the solar system is you can't always get down there on the ground with your shovel and dig up materials and really get the sort of information we geologists on Earth get about our world. So you rely on orbital imagery, and sometimes it's not as high resolution as you want. There are some spacecraft in the solar system that can see down to the meter scale or less, and these are some wonderful instruments, the LROC instrument on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter and the HiRISE instrument on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. But for Titan, you're trapped above the atmosphere, so you can't get quite as close. And like I said before, you can't see anything at those visible wavelengths, so you rely on the radar wavelengths. And so the best resolution we can get is 300 meters. So you can imagine what you can fit in 300 meters without being able to see it.
Okay. And so now you're clearly seeing the surface of Titan through the radar images you're looking at. Can you tell anything about the history of Titan, like through time? You know, we're seeing what we see now. What are there any ideas about what it was like in the past? If it's changed?
Lots of ideas. Actually, Titan is very strange in that it has an atmosphere at all. The component that's keeping its atmosphere there, it's keeping it warm, is methane. If there wasn't methane, you wouldn't have enough global warming, essentially, to keep Titan warm enough for an atmosphere. Without this methane, the atmosphere would collapse. But methane should be destroyed from that atmosphere by the sun on the order of tens to hundreds of millions of years. The solar system, in comparison, is 4.5 billion years long. So why is there methane currently on Titan, and why is there an atmosphere right now? Is it just a fluke? Or perhaps there's some process that's taking methane, perhaps from the interior of Titan, and bringing it to the surface and into the atmosphere. So there's some questions about what is the history of methane on Titan. Has it always had an atmosphere? Is this an ephemeral feature? Does it go away? But in general, Titan appears to be very, very young. So one way that we date the surfaces of planets is by counting the number of impact craters there. So the idea is, you have a blank canvas, essentially, and then rocks and ice from the solar system fall on that planet and make impact craters. And the longer time you have, the more craters you'll find there. And so we can use this to tell that the moon, for example, is very old. It appears to be very old. And the Earth is relatively young. We don't see too many impact craters on the Earth because there's been plate tectonics and volcanism and all sorts and erosional processes that are destroying these craters. And when we look at Titan, it doesn't look like the moon. It looks like the Earth. We've counted perhaps 60 craters in total. In comparison, the moon, Mercury, other planets have thousands of craters. So Titan appears to be a very young world, and it's unclear whether that's due to erosional processes or whether there was some large event, perhaps, that resurfaced the whole planet, like we suspect may have happened on Venus, which also has an extremely young surface.
It's fascinating. So all of these things that you're learning about Titan, its young surface and this thick atmosphere and methane, are there things that you can apply to expanding our knowledge of Earth or even the rest of the solar system? Where does it fit into that larger picture?
Sure. The great thing about studying other planets in the solar system is it gives us other data points for understanding fundamental processes. So you can see a process on Earth and understand it empirically by gathering data. But if you then see the same process on other planets, you can sort of dig into the theory behind what causes those processes to happen by having several data points. The other exciting thing about Titan is it might be sort of a representative of what the Earth might turn into in the future. So we can use it as an analog for our own future. As the sun gets hotter, our oceans will begin to evaporate. We may begin to lose our water. But before we turn into something like Venus, which has no water on its surface, and all of any water it had has been evaporated and now lives in the atmosphere. So in the future, the Earth might lose its water, and we might get equatorial deserts, and all the water being forced to the poles before, as it evaporates, as the sun warms. And Titan looks very much like that picture. So I mentioned it didn't have that global ocean, but it does have lakes and seas of liquids at its poles. And then it has a very dry equatorial sand seas that seem to bracket its equator. And so perhaps we're seeing that last gasp of a world that with liquid on its surface before the liquids all go away.
That's fascinating. That idea that we often hear on Earth, you know, we look through the geological record into the past, and we look to the moon for our past, and the idea of looking at other planetary bodies as our future or what it could potentially look like is fascinating. So can you walk us through what missions have already taken place surrounding Titan?
Sure.
And maybe have a look to the future, or maybe dreaming of what, for example, you would like to do there if you had the choice.
Well, the list of missions that have been to Titan is relatively short. There were the Voyager missions in the late 70s and early 80s. One of the Voyagers went on past Saturn to investigate Uranus and Neptune, but the second Voyager actually stopped at Saturn, and they actually altered its orbit so it could get a close look at Titan. So this is how important people thought Titan was. The second Voyager did not go on to Uranus and Neptune. We wanted to have a good look at Titan. And actually, prior to that point, we knew very little about Titan other than it appeared to have an atmosphere with methane. But when we got there, we had a chance to investigate its atmosphere in more detail. Unfortunately, none of the cameras on Voyager were able to see through this big, smoggy atmosphere it has, but we did learn a lot about that atmosphere. We also learned how big Titan was. People didn't know how big Titan was before Voyager. Because of its big, big atmosphere, you couldn't see through that atmosphere to the surface. So there were some thoughts that it was warm enough at the surface that you could have liquid water and perhaps a habitable world. But unfortunately, we discovered that Titan was a cold planet, but with a wonderful atmosphere rich in organic molecules, perhaps the stuff of life.
Well, I was just going to ask, Inza, so how big is it? You're saying that.
Oh, right,
that's
right. it is slightly smaller than Ganymede, and Ganymede is the largest moon in the solar system.
Okay.
However, it is bigger than Mercury. It is a planetary body that just happens to orbit Saturn. If it didn't orbit Saturn, we would certainly call it a planet. It's large. It has an atmosphere. It is probably more planet-like than many of the planets.
Fascinating.
Not to say anything bad about Mercury. I love Mercury, too.
You still love Mercury. So after the Voyager mission, what happened next?
Well, there was a bit of a lag. Going to the outer solar system takes a long time and a lot of planning, and so it wasn't until, as I said, 2004 that Cassini arrived. And Cassini was a dedicated Saturn orbiter. So while the Voyager missions had just flown past Jupiter and Saturn, Uranus and Neptune, Cassini was there to stay. And it's been there since 2004. It's 8 years old now. Well, 8 years since it arrived. It was launched in 1997. And we've just been learning so much about Saturn and its moons and its rings. It's been an amazing data set, and it's supposed to go on for many years to come, ending somewhere around 2017 with a very dramatic dive into Saturn's ring. So
that'll be in a minute.
Stay tuned for that. But there's only so much we can do with Cassini. Since we knew so little about Titan before Cassini arrived, it was hard to sort of tweak the mission to do all the science we might want to do now. So we really, I think, need to go back to Titan with a more specialized set of instruments to investigate all these many features we didn't even know existed 8 years ago. And one of the most interesting are these lakes of liquid hydrocarbons at its north and south poles. And so there actually is plans in the works to try to send a boat to Titan, the first boat to travel an extraterrestrial sea.
That'd be remarkable.
It would be really, really cool. So NASA is in the process of choosing its next Discovery mission. Discovery is the cheapest class of mission that NASA runs, and by cheap, I mean $500 million. So it's not that cheap. And so last year, they narrowed it down to three finalists. And one of them is this concept called the Titan Mare Explorer, or TIME. And so the idea of TIME is that you would launch this capsule from the Earth, it would travel to Saturn, and then land on Titan's, one of its seas of liquid hydrocarbons near the North Pole. It would determine what the lakes are made out of. It's actually really hard to tell how much methane is in a lake when you're looking through a big atmosphere made of methane. So we don't know how much methane is in those lakes, let alone any smaller byproducts of the amazing chemistry that's happening in Titan's atmosphere. We also don't know how deep the lakes are, so we can learn something about their depth, how much liquid is there. We can take pictures of the shoreline, perhaps, and use it as a weather station to understand Titan's meteorology. It's an Earth-like world, as I said, and so it has its own weather system, and we can learn about that using this boat. So I'm really excited about it, and I hope, fingers crossed, I hope NASA chooses TIME for its next mission. We'll learn their decision this summer. So
I think we'll all have our fingers crossed. I'm envisioning this remarkable boat that would have, I think you listed up at least four types of experiments, atmospheric, getting the chemistry of the water. I imagine this is still in development in terms of what instruments would be chosen for such a mission?
No, actually they planned that out far in advance.
Okay.
Yeah. It's amazing how far in advance you need to plan a mission and nail down all these very specific details. If it does launch, it won't even get there until 2023. So these missions take a very long time to plan, and you want to get it, you go through many iterations, but you want to get it right sort of as soon as you can to start bringing your team together and focusing in on the instruments that you need. While Discovery missions are great, as I said, they are the cheapest mission NASA runs, so you really have to be efficient about your science and only choose those instruments that will really tackle the questions that are really critical to planetary science.
It sounds like it'd be an amazing project to be part of. It also sounds incredibly like you're saying long-term.
Yes.
Starting now, this is something not happening till 2023. So you've mentioned that such a mission to Titan is a long-term affair. Even starting now with all this planning that's already happened, you're not going until 2023.
Well, it would launch in 2016. It just takes 7 years to get to Saturn.
Okay, so how many people, I'm just thinking about this career-wise, and I know you've been involved in previous missions, are able to stay involved for the entire length of these missions to the outer planet?
I mean, I got involved in Cassini right when it got to Saturn, when I started graduate school in 2004, but it launched when I was 16. So there's no way I would have been involved in Cassini from the start. So you really have to bring in, in my case, I was a graduate student or a postdoctoral researcher, and then get them involved in the mission as, you know, as people age. And, you know, and sadly sometimes they pass away before the mission gets there. But I think it's sort of like, you know, the circle of life in some respects. You set things in motion to benefit future generations. And, of course, you hope that you will you'll be there to see the mission be successful. And in most cases, I mean, we don't have to be morbid, I mean, in most cases, yes, the people involved in these missions do. But there is a lack of younger folks capable to PI, be a principal investigator for these missions. And so I think it's really, as a community, we need to start training people like myself and in my generation to get these skills. So we won't be faced with a lack of qualified individuals to lead these missions, not only to the outer solar system, but anywhere in the solar system. So that's something I think hopefully we'll have a conversation about as a community.
Yeah. And I guess I suppose it might be a tricky thing given the rate or the slowing down rate of missions that are being launched in the next, say, 10 to 20 years and really focusing and making sure these opportunities are potentially used, bringing on new scientists and early career folks.
Well, I'm of course all for that for my own selfish reasons. But I think it does benefit the community as a whole.
Absolutely. Talking about careers in planetary science, I'm curious, how did you get here? How did you end up where you are today doing this type of research?
Well, I was a bit of a nerd as a child. I was a big fan of science fiction novels and so forth. But I think it was mostly in high school that I really decided that I wanted to be an astronomer. And then later, I honed that down to a planetary scientist. And, you know, of course, retrospect is 2020. Looking back on my career, I can almost trace it all, and this is sort of embarrassing, to the movie Contact.
Wonderful movie.
Wonderful movie. Wonderful book, which I read before seeing the movie. And seeing that movie when I was 16 years old, also the year Cassini launched, it made me really excited about being an astronomer. And so excited that when I was an undergraduate, I applied for a research position at Arecibo Observatory, which is the world's largest radio telescope in Puerto Rico, featured quite heavily in Contact. That's where she's searching for life, although they don't actually do too much of that anymore. And so I went to Arecibo, and that's where I learned about radar. Arecibo is not only the world's largest radio telescope, it also sends radar beams out into space, and which bounce off objects in our own solar system. And you can learn lots about those objects, about their properties, their orbits, their sizes, and interiors. And so I was introduced to this whole world. Prior to that point, I'd been, I guess, a classical, more observational astronomer, where you just sort of sit there passively and wait for the universe to send you its signals. But for the first time, I saw that you could be an experimental astronomer. You could tweak knobs and send out a signal and get exactly the science that you wanted. And that really appealed to me. So when I started graduate school a year later, I wanted to keep radar in my research plans, and I was very fortunate to be at a place involved with the Cassini mission, and in particular the Cassini radar instrument, which has, as I said previously, you know, shown us so many amazing features on the surface of Titan.
That's wonderful. Just to wrap up, if people want to learn more about the techniques that you use radar, using these instruments on orbiters around planetary bodies, or to see some of these images, where can they go? Do you have a website, for example, to recommend?
Google is amazing, and NASA has a lot of great websites displaying their data. So if you were to type in planetary radar, you'll probably get some really great things, or Cassini. There's also a radar on the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, which I also work on, and we have some amazing images, so I feel like we need more time.
I think we're going to be fine. So, great. Well, I don't know how to end.
That's all, folks.
Thanks, Catherine. Thanks so much for joining us today. It was wonderful hearing about your research, and hopefully you can come and chat with us again, maybe about some of your other studies.
Thanks very much, Marianne. It was a lot of fun.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion. Well, we just finished listening to Marianne's interview with Catherine Nish, and I've got to say, I'm always struck. We go so far out in the solar system to these exotic places, you know, tholins and organics raining down from the sky onto a surface made of water ice at 200 degrees below zero, and we find things that remind us of home. We find rivers and lakes and fog and deserts and dunes. I mean, just an incredible landscape on Titan. The more things are different, the more they seem the same sometimes.
Well, it looks superficially a lot like Earth, but it is a very strange and bizarre place that's made of liquid methane and solid particles of ethane and ice and sand and all kinds of strange things.
What I find really interesting is that we weren't supposed to find that stuff. And there were literally dozens of experiments in the lab with water ice, with liquid methane at those temperatures, that showed that you could not possibly, you know, zero chance that you could erode water ice with methane. And so we were going to have this really sort of, you know, subdued, pristine world in terms of the forms of ice with this liquid sort of draped over it. And instead, we find it looks like any other planet with a hydrological, or in this case, a methanological cycle.
You talk about any other planet with a cycle like that. There actually aren't very many that we know, right?
Just the one, really.
I'd argue two.
Well, you know, we have Earth and Mars that have some kind of precipitation happening and some erosion, and we have Titan, and the list is starting to run short after that.
Titan, if it hadn't shown those features, would have been a more diagnostic case on the variety that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but here we are with this, you know, thick, opaque atmosphere. It's a bit like Venus, you know, you don't know anything about the planet until you go look from up close with something that can peer through clouds. And then you find this bizarre and inexplicable world underneath.
Now, the interesting thing with Titan is it's not that we hadn't tried before, because we'd sent Pioneer 11 there, which did that first determination of the size. And then we actually, as Catherine mentioned, we actually bet Voyager 1, all of it, the spacecraft, on getting a close-up view to Titan. It took it away from that gravitational keyhole to send it out to the outer solar system. So after Titan, that was it.
We got really lucky with Voyager 2 that it didn't die. But that was why there were two of them.
Right.
For a certain amount of redundancy on this.
That's right. And so it was an easier choice, I think, to actually send Voyager 1 to take a close look at Titan, knowing that Voyager 2 was in reserve. Now, we did actually see a little bit of the surface of Titan with Voyager 1. We just didn't know it at the time. After you take the maps and process the images, this was something that was done by Jim Richardson at Arizona, you actually do see a little bit of the surface. But you have to know what you're looking for. That's the problem.
So were there portions where the clouds were not as opaque? Or?
Well, it has to do with the filters, because there are windows in the methane atmosphere of Titan. And you can see all the way to the surface if you know where to look.
Okay.
And if you have adaptive optics, because Titan is such a tiny, tiny body. It's actually kind of interesting. There was an old measurement back in the 1800s by José Comas Solá.
Okay.
And he claimed that he could see an atmosphere. And so he's sort of held up as, you know, this great Depression guy who was able to see such small effects. But the width of Titan is about the same width as Schiaparelli's canals, using similar equipment.
Yeah, it's another case of, you know, drawing conclusions when you have limited data.
Well, in this case, though, he happened to be right, so history will stand by him, unlike Schiaparelli with his canals.
Well, you know, right by accident is only marginally better than wrong, I guess. But it's fun to see that we're able to learn so much about Titan from having a radar in place. There might be a couple of lines where, in the visible or infrared, you can kind of see through the clouds, but the radar makes a big difference.
Exactly, and that's the same technique, that synthetic aperture radar, or SAR, that the space shuttles used to do mapping on Earth, and that Magellan used on last week's subject, Venus.
And that Mars Express uses to look at ice below the surface on Mars. And that RadarSat uses... I mean, synthetic aperture radar used to be a revolutionary thing, and now it's
everywhere.
It's a central tool for Earth observation and planetary exploration.
There's high school students building these things for science fair projects now. And 10 years ago, it was in NASA labs. It's pretty impressive.
Absolutely. And, you know, as we say, there are a lot of things that you can't see through those kind of atmospheres, be it thick clouds at Earth or haze and smog in the upper atmosphere of Titan.
Right. And you mentioned Mars Express and the MARSIS instrument. You can actually get a little bit of extra material back out of this. You find out how that material interacts, not just, you know, how flat it is, which is how you detect things like
like lakes. You can see the lakes because they're these big, gaping, dark areas where all the radar energy is reflected out away from the spacecraft. But in areas where some of that radar energy is absorbed and some is reflected back, you can learn a little bit about material properties.
Yeah, surface roughness and the electrical properties of the surface.
That's right.
Yeah. And things that you might not tell from an optical image.
No, it's really hard to look at something and know its dielectric constant.
Mm-hmm. It's true. That's one of the reasons we know that the dunes around the equator are made of the stuff that falls out of the sky. They're made of the tholen and not of ice.
Mm-hmm. So the analogy isn't sand dunes. It would be snow dunes.
Well, these are more like coffee ground dunes.
Well, true, but falling from the sky, it would be snow. You know, the terrestrial analogy.
I like coffee grounds.
Coffee grounds falling from the sky. I wouldn't want to brew these tholens. I don't think it would make a really satisfying cup of joe.
And this is an interesting interaction that we get. The tholens are produced when ultraviolet light interacts with the nitrogen in the atmosphere and with the methane. You get all of these crazy compounds formed and these huge fractal particles. And that's what gives Titan its lovely Halloween color.
And some of these huge fractal particles could contain precursors to life, as experiments going back to the 70s and earlier suggest.
Yeah, this is another crazy question. So here we have all of this strange sort of organic chemistry happening, catalyzed by the UV radiation. And here we have kind of a hydrological cycle and kind of lakes and rivers made of methane and things. So could you imagine some kind of exotic life that could develop or use that kind of environment?
Well, some people do, of course. Mm-hmm. And we have mysteries, as always, with these sorts of things. We've been unable so far to detect acetylene in the lower atmosphere.
We should
be able to find it, but it doesn't seem to be there. And the surprising thing is that of all of this organic soup, this is the one with the strongest bonds. This is the one that is the most potent energy source, if there did happen to be something living there. At the same time, as Catherine pointed out, it's 94 Kelvin. Any reactions that happen there happen really, really slowly.
Yeah, so it's difficult to imagine some kind of biological system that is able to run through cycles of life and cycles of organic molecules and the things that happen in nuclei. It's hard to imagine that happening when they would have to be so very slowed down.
It would be cell division on a generational scale, but it would still happen.
Yeah,
still happen.
Yeah, if you could even get to the level of organization of having cells.
True.
You have to have your information-carrying molecules, your nucleic acids or whatnot.
There have been suggestions of people saying there can be life under the thick sheet of whatever it is, probably at the center, which is probably heated up due to its interaction with the Sarton, its home mother body. But this all like speculation, still like a suggestion.
Yeah, it does really get warmer deeper in, which could encourage life to form, but then you don't have that nice energy source from the atmosphere of the acetylene. Potential.
But it's an interesting problem. We've got this question on the Earth as to whether life form sort of top down interaction with the sun at the surface, or whether it's bottom up sort of mm-hmm. from these black smoker type of things. And water is a weird thing. I mean, it's a good thing for us that ice doesn't sink, otherwise the oceans would be frozen solid by now for us. But when you get out to these icy moons and you get all this pressure, you can get these liquid layers underneath the surface that are huge. And with all of the energy inside these bodies, you have to wonder what's cooking in that soup.
Yeah, and Titan seems to be one of the places where there may be one of these liquid layers underneath, sandwiched between solid water.
Exactly, yeah. And there might be some of this methane, because it keeps getting replenished on the surface from somewhere, as Catherine mentioned.
Yeah, and we really don't understand where that would come from. When we see a little bit of methane on Mars, we start to jump up and down about about organic processes and that.
Well, on Mars in particular, methane is much more unstable in the atmosphere mm-hmm. than on Titan.
Another interesting thing with Titan is the exploration. Because it's come along so late in our exploration of the solar system, there's kind of been steps skipped. All of the spacecraft that have visited Mars and all the tries we had to do to get more and more time on the surface and more time orbiting around, we just went straight to a lander, which was very successful, the Huygens probe. And there are even more ambitious things coming up, I believe.
Yeah, the most interesting part was hearing how Catherine was talking about the boat.
Yeah, this time proposal. Yeah.
Which is
Titan Mare Explorer.
Which is pretty interesting. I mean, having to test what these lakes, icy sheets are made of and what lies beneath those sheets is very interesting. Probably to actually figure out what's causing this methane cycle. Is there life underneath those sheets? So this kind of probes can be very useful and probably a stepping stone, as she says, for next generation of scientists to work on.
And it would be an absolutely unique plan, right?
Yeah.
There's nowhere else that we've sent some kind of marine craft. For all these probes called Mariner, not one of them. Right?
That's right. I find it interesting, though, that you can really use that atmosphere and do some things that hadn't been thought about. Our listeners may not be aware, but there was a Discovery proposal a few years ago that was still in sort of the back of my mind called Aviator that Jason Barnes put out. Because you've got that thick atmosphere, because you've got such a low gravitational constant, you could imagine a nuclear-powered aircraft just going around and around and around.
Quite easily. Could you imagine a methane-powered aircraft?
Well, you would need to bring an oxidizer, so that doesn't work.
I recommend nuclear power. More reliable. Yeah. Lasts longer.
Yeah, very likely. But yeah, I mean, you know, of all the places in the solar system, this is an exciting spot for aviation.
Now, this is the only one where human-powered flight is not only practicable, but you could have human-powered ornithopters. You're light enough that your arms are strong enough to power wings to actually propel you off the surface, at least in one paper I read.
You'd need a serious parka, though?
Yeah, well, yes.
And a scuba set?
Generally, we call those spacesuits, but...
Yeah, you'd have to keep warm, I guess. But, yeah, the idea that you can explore... There's the only world where it seems practical to explore with boats and airplanes and all of the things we'd want to use here on the Earth. I'm really excited at the idea of extraterrestrial aircraft.
Well, there have been proposals for Mars and Venus as well. With Mars's tenuous atmosphere, it's a little harder.
But, it is harder.
And with Venus's hot, acidic
atmosphere... You just stay above the cloud layer.
But we've done it. We've done it. The Russians did it with a balloon.
Mm-hmm.
And the balloon has also been suggested for Titan. Mm-hmm. But you can't do it with the giant planets, unfortunately, because the working gas is hydrogen. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very hard to hold things up.
Yeah. Well, that's for Titan. I guess one of the key questions is, you know, aside from this time proposal, you know, if that one is not selected, it'll be a while before we're able to go back there. We don't have another Saturn mission in construction.
Even with time is the early 2020s.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cassini right now is going through at least 2017, which is when we get that exciting geophysical mission where it goes in between the rings.
Mm-hmm.
But beyond that, it's not clear what the strategy is in the outer solar system, especially with what's been happening in terms of budget cuts lately at places like NASA.
You think of other icy places with atmospheres, Uranus and Neptune, for example, these are still only barely explored.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have too many missions in preparation for those either.
It's a good point. With the ice giants, a whole other class of these giant planets that really informs what we know about a lot of extrasolar planets, we've only had that one flyby by Voyager 2.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, we're not going to get another one, at least on the table now, until sometime in the 2030s if the budget cycle allows.
And never mind budgets. I mean, just in practical terms, it's very difficult to get there.
Yes.
Voyager 2 was making use of gravitational assists of planets that were nicely lined up on the way out, but that arrangement doesn't come around very often.
No.
And it makes a big difference. I mean, because of the way that the planets were arranged, we could get Cassini, which weighs 6 tons, all the way out to Saturn, whereas New Horizons, which was going direct if it had to, Jupiter if it could, and did get that Jupiter assist, it's only 420 kilos.
Yeah, and that makes a tremendous difference in the amount of fuel you can carry and instrumentation that you can make use of. But in any case, it's an exotic world. It's Titan. We have a great deal to learn about it. And the more we find, the more it looks both bizarre and familiar at the same time.
It really is on the cutting edge of planetary science and exploration.
In fact, this is why we get into planetary science. It's for the mysteries.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Marianne Mader. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, Parshadi Patel, and John Moores. Our editors were Michael Forrester and John Moores, and, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here, at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.